This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Coming up in the second half of today's show, we talk about Tuba Christmas. But we are going to start today talking about different ways to calm our minds and our bodies during this very stressful, busy time that is Christmas. But of course, you can do this outside of a busy time of year. I am in studio with Christy Goulet. She is going to be teaching a class on Indigenous meditation. She is an enrolled member of the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa, and she is a medicine woman. Christy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, Nana Baju, wish Kabijin to be equi Dijna cause, and I'm very honored to be here this morning.
I want to start with following the guideline from Ojibwe scholar Dr. Anton Troyer, who says that you should always ask someone if they prefer the term Indian, Indigenous, Native. You call your class Indigenous, so I think that's your preferred term. Why?
Indigenous refers to where geographically you came from. And when we go back to our Anishinaabe origin story, our belief system, we were created on this continent. And at that time, the water was flooded. And the Anishinaabe were more to the east of where we are now. And we traveled to this area in order to find food that grew on the water, is what the spirits told them. And so that's what the Anishinaabes did. And we were also told that Aki, which is Mother Earth, is in the shape of a turtle. And so we know it as Turtle Island. And so we're indigenous to Turtle Island, which is North America. And so, again, that's why I refer to myself as indigenous, coming from Turtle Island.
Okay. When you do a Google image search of meditation, and I counted 50 images, and they were all the classic seated, cross-legged, hands, palms up on the knees, sometimes touching thumb to a forefinger. And then I thought, okay, well, this is the only image representation of meditation. In your practice, what does it look like?
When I do my class at Morehead Community Education, I actually bring in a female horsehide robe, and I lay that down. I also bring my dwagon, which is a drum, and I have a wagmuha, which is a Dakota word for a rattle. And I bring these items in. I also have a smudge bowl. Which is, it's an abalone shell. An abalone is an animal that lived in the ocean. And I put sage in it. And I bring these spiritual items with me. And in the room that we do it for community education, I keep the lights lowered because we want that sense of calm and serene. When I do this, because this is a ceremony. And in this ceremony, when I'm brought out onto the prairie, and in Dakota, it's known as Humblecha, which is a vision quest. And so when I go out onto the prairie, I am covered with a star quilt when I come out of the sweat lodge. And I'm brought out onto a location where nobody is going to come to that place. And the vow that you can make is you can go from one night and one day, and the longest we're allowed to go is 4 nights and 5 days, no food and no water. And nobody can come to you, and you're completely alone to center yourself, not only with your own nage, which is your spirit, but to everything else that is created around us. And for myself and the people that I was mentored under, the most important relationship is one that comes from the Creator. And the Anishinaabe call him Manidu, Gichi Manidu is how you say God in Ojibwe, and the Dakota call the Creator Tukanshla Wakantaka. And having that sense of relationship with the Creator, I can then listen to what Creator manifested me for on the earth with a sense of purpose. And a lot of people struggle with what is my identity, what is my purpose, and do I really want to evolve and grow into a human being that can be passionate about beliefs that help shape the identity of the world that we live in today. And during that time, there's no food, there's no water. We're in prayer. And I come away with a stronger sense of not only identity, but peace within, because I fulfilled my belief system as it's passed down for thousands of years. Mm-hmm. And so I bring that essence into the classroom by showing them the items that I pray with that have brought me peace. And one of my mentors, they actually adopted me. It's called the Hunka ceremony, which is a making of a relative. The Lakota have seven sacred ceremonies. And with the Hunka ceremony, Hehanka Wainipi, which is the elk come to see him, his English name was Ambrose Little Ghost, and his wife's name is Wambalia Shnalawia. And Hehanka Wainipi said to me, the secret to life is to find peace within. Because if all that you're doing is manifesting anger or resentment or guilt or shame or even unattainable goals, then you're missing the understanding that life is about peace within.
Yeah.
And he found that peace within through ceremonial rite of passage. He held on to it when it was outlawed, like we had spoke, under the American Indian Religious Freedom Act of 1978. They lived that way. And I had somebody ask me one time, they said, do you practice your traditional ways? And I said, do you practice breathing? It's not that. It's a constant frame of mind that we manifest. So no matter what is going on, I stay in control of those emotions, and I can make the best decision for all the realms. If we look at the medicine wheel, you have mental, emotional, physical, and spiritual health. And those four components have to stay in alignment, or you're kind of going on a flat wheel, a flat tire, we say.
Mm.
And it's never humanly possible to be 100%, but we're always knowledgeable that there's work to do in a certain area, and we don't stress about it, but we actually have a plan that we initiate that will bring us to fruition of what it is that we're setting with our goals.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, for a class through continuing ed, it's not a four-day-long class where people are sitting in stillness and in touch with the Creator without food or water. You're teaching a one-day version.
Mm-hmm.
But it is called Indigenous meditation. Is someone supposed to be Indigenous to practice this style?
Absolutely not. Everybody is Indigenous, and you're Indigenous to your home country or your home belief. And the melting pot of America brought all of the individuals here. So I laugh sometimes, and I call them my Scandahoovian friends, and which is good because some of them, they come from Norway. They come from Denmark. They're Finnish. The Sami, they also had a sweat lodge, and they also found a way to cleanse themselves and to bring themselves to peace. And so when I bring people that are welcome to come into my class, they can then manifest for themselves Indigenous teachings that have helped Indigenous people transcend through some of the most horrific experiences that this country was founded on. And coming to peace with that, it's also a healing for them too, because a lot of times the people that come into my class are unaware of the historical significance of these ceremonies being absolutely forbidden. It was the American Offenses Act where you couldn't even – we weren't allowed to have these spiritual items. We weren't allowed to speak this language. We weren't allowed to sing these songs to burn sage. And so, you know, we touch on that a little bit. And what is hard for individuals in the healing process of decolonizing America is it creates a sense of shame. And the minute that people feel, even though it wasn't me that did this, but there's some sort of connection of shame, they shut down.
Your back's against the wall.
Yep.
You get angry.
Because they're defensive. All of a sudden. But if we don't learn how to transcend through anger, because anger is a second emotion of fear. And so that fear that underlines that, that maybe their ancestors or – and, you know, and even Indigenous people, there were times when some of our Indigenous warriors did go on rampages. They went completely Huitco, which was crazy because they were just so subjected and retaliation was their only form. And I never – they felt it was. And I never promote violence because we're not going to get to a place of healing to change the historical traumas that have happened if we can't recognize them and deconstruct that thinking in order to move forward again. And so some of the individuals in my class, the last one that I held, there was actually a young lady who worked for community education. And she became very emotional in the second half of the class because she hadn't – I honestly believe she hadn't slowed down enough to get in touch with those emotions. And once she started slowing down, it was kind of like overwhelming her. And then she hears a little bit of the history of how we've had to endure and persevere and transcend. Mm. Indigenous people always have had – we've always had pandemics. We've always had – floods. Mm-hmm. We've always had drought. We've always had times of famine. And yet we've always still persevered.
It's a struggle to be a human.
It is. And but yet, you know, there's enlightenment that comes with every experience of transcending through what we see as these horrific experiences. Mm. That is the sense of what you get from meditation is now I've made it through and I've learned something from it. And do I appreciate the feeling that it evokes in me to say, now this is what peace within feels like? Mm. Because I like how peace feels.
Yeah.
And yes.
So what do you notice? What does it feel like when you have a strong meditation practice?
The sense of it's not necessarily euphoria, but there's a definite weight that you feel in a clearer sense of thought. Your thoughts are clearer. So if you had specific goals, you can see that specific path to those goals and not just see the obstacles that's not allowing you attain what that is that you're trying to manifest, whether that be physical. A lot of people right now are struggling. We're even myself, you know, we want to turn to food to take the feeling of this not being able to get enough of what I feel life has to offer, mm-hmm. and or I'm not living up to that. And so food is a satisfactory tool. It makes us – and it's one of our original survival tools.
Yeah.
We needed food, shelter, and clothing. Those three necessities, when met, those are the things that transpire you to not just feel like you're surviving, but you're thriving. And when people have a sense after they practiced, because it takes time to learn how to meditate. An elder told me one time, prayer is talking to the Creator. Meditating is taking time to listen to the Creator. And do you take that time throughout your day? So before I get out of bed every morning, I have a meditation book. It's called Cherokee Feast of Days. And I read the meditation. It's by Indigenous elders. And it teaches me to not think of self, but think of worldly experiences that need to be identified for us, especially as an Indigenous person, to hold on to. There's a value system within that. And after I'm done reading that, I pray. And there's complete silence. There's no phone on. You know, I get up a little bit earlier than everybody else. So I have that 15 to 20 minutes of complete quiet. And I can listen to my own nage. And I remember having a conversation with Wambali Ashinalawea one time, and we were watching somebody and they were talking to themselves. Mm-hmm. And sometimes in Western society, they want to label that as abnormal.
Right.
And Indigenous people say that's your way of reasoning with your nage. It's your way of self-rationalization to talk yourself through it. Mm-hmm. And then when you have a good niji, which would be a friend or a support system, and you bounce those ideas off of them, and it's not asking for verification or validity to what that is, but maybe to open it up for, oh, I had lived this experience and this is how I made it through. And you get a suggestion that you would not be able to come with an idea on your own on how to transcend through an experience or sometimes learning how to just let things be and let things go. We live in a society where it's very materialistic mm-hmm. and it's instant gratification. Those are not always a self-fulfilling way to feed your nage because it comes quickly, so therefore it goes quickly. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have a time to manifest itself. With meditation, that clear path of thinking, when I'm asking for – and it could be I want to lose 10 pounds. What is my goal to lose that 10 pounds? And we, you know, for being the human being that I am, procrastination and, oh, but the kids need this or, uh-huh. you know, I'm involved
There's
with this.
The murder.
Yeah, you know, and the laundry, you know, nobody's just going to do that. But again, if I'm not well, none of these other things will be well either.
You can't pour from an empty cup.
You will never. And Indigenous people always believe, at least for my mentors, spiritual precedes material. So when spiritual is well, everything else will fall into place. Mm-hmm. And that's the feeling that I enjoy every day and in every second because I control my emotions. I help a lot of people with addiction issues. And the specific ones are drugs and alcohol. You know, meth is an epidemic. Mm-hmm. And what I remind them is when you're using, you're not in control of your emotions. They're in control of you. And you cannot – you don't have the ability then to make decisions in your best interest. Indigenous people make decisions that affect seven generations after us. And some people could say, well, that's too overwhelming. It wasn't because our ancestors did it in order for me to even be here talking about the issues of meditation, peace, understanding the genocide and the traumas that we – transcended through to be at the place that the Creator allows us the privilege to be in where I'm at today. Mm-hmm. And that radiates from people. People feel that. And in recovery, people say the program is not based on promotion but attraction. And in Anishinaabe and Ojibwe, when you say Aning, it means I see your light. And so your aura and those that can see that maybe around you can see maybe there's something blocking that aura. We have a saying, your spirit is like an ego bone whistle. And if you blow that ego bone whistle and nothing comes out, there's something blocking it. In order to live life, you'll always have to heal from something. You always have to grow. And there's four cycles of life, a child, a young adult, the middle-aged, and then the elder. And emotionally, how do you transcend through those realms into the next emotional place that you should be? Because mm-hmm. stage should equal age. And that's why people with addiction issues struggle mm-hmm. is because they're 40, but their mentality is that of a 14-year-old. We need to give them unconditional love because they don't love themselves. Because if mm-hmm. they did, they wouldn't try and kill themselves. Mm-hmm. And then we bring them back to a place where they're getting that. And then they can feel comfortable and build trust and start to grow with that. If we can't start with self, we can't start with anybody else. So these are a way of just believing. And that's why I humblecha, I've gone up 7 times throughout my life.
That's the vision quest.
Vision quested. 6 of those were done where I was literally taken out on the prairie. And I went up. My first year was under Hehanka Wainipi. And I went up for 1 night and 1 day. My second and third year, I went to a place called Thunder Valley on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. So you're in the Black Hills. And I went up for 2 nights and 3 days, no food or water.
And that's sacred land.
It is very sacred land. And people come there and they see the abject poverty because of the buildings and sparse location of it. But they fail to see the spiritual power and the prayer of the Lakota people and what has kept them who they are. And in the language are the metaphors for how you live your life. So that's why it's very imperative for all people to keep their original languages. Mm-hmm. And everybody had one. Coming to America, we're becoming colonized, so they only want you to speak English. Mm-hmm. That is a violation of your civil rights. And so Indigenous people recognize that. But if we can't understand the metaphors for how we conduct ourselves and how life is to guide us, then part of us is lost. And so going back and reclaiming that identity was what I was so privileged to learn from the Lakota. Even though I wasn't a Lakota, I sundanced with them. Mm-hmm. I brought as much good energy as I could. I tried to help out with setting up Sundance arbors and cooking food and helping with anything that needed to be done to make our ceremonies. So when the spirits come in, they give us very specific instructions on how we move forward with things. And Wambly Howeshde was a young man. It means eagle with a good voice. And beautiful. We come back. I've learned one of his songs, and he said, "These songs are from the spirits. Take them home and heal your communities." And then when I came back to North Dakota, Dekshi Wambidi Nupa means two eagles. And he is our oldest Sundance leader at Maniwakan Oyate Spirit Lake Nation. Mm-hmm. And his Sundance has been going for 23 years. It's called Bears Afraid of Him. And I was honored to be put up for Humblecha under him.
Wow.
Three times. And he left me up for 2 nights and 3 days. I went up and prayed. And the sixth year, I did the whole 4 nights and 5 days on another district of Maniwakan called the Rolling Hills District, which was actually 1 mile from Wambly Ishnalawiya's house. Mm-hmm. Because she prayed so long and so hard for her ways to come back, they literally brought it right next door to her house. And she was there every morning before the sun came up, supporting the sun dancers. Because as they're elderly, they may not be able to dance, mm-hmm. but they're the knowledge keepers. They speak the language. They know the songs. They give us support and encouragement to say, just keep growing. And then the last time I went up, I actually went into the sweat lodge. I have my own inipi. It means to be born again in Lakota, or Madudu Swan is how we say it in Ojibwe. And my son, Tatanka Wagmuha Milo, his name means big gourd or big rattle. His English name is Dallas Goulet. He's 35 years old. And he stayed. I ran the Madudu Swan, and I bring community members in. And they're from treatment centers. Prairie at St. John's would put them in cabs and send them to my house because they said she has a way that will help the people. That's how much they believe in unifying the medicines of both the Western and the traditional culture to do anything that we could to at least say we have done something to help the people. And after I ran that ceremony, I had people with cars waiting, and then the individuals went with the rides back to wherever they were staying at. And a star quilt, I put a star quilt over myself. Mm-hmm. Because by that point in life, I know what I'm doing. I don't need a spiritual leader to help me. Mm-hmm. I was becoming.
You have become that.
And now I'm honored to be able to help others with that ceremony. So I have the right to help other women go up if they choose to. I would suggest for men to go. I would bring them to our male leaders, our male spiritual advisors. And so when I went into the lodge, I stayed for 1 night and 1 day, and my son made the fire the next day, and that's how I broke my fast and came out. And so just again, we have no words. That's why it's called Wakan, is mysterious and it's sacred and it's holy.
Cannot be named.
It can't. But it's a feeling. And the feeling is love. And the feeling is love and compassion. And I remember Gigay Beneshi, his name is Spotted Thunderbird. He had the oldest Madudu Swan on the White Earth Reservation. And he said, if all the people could just get together and pray, we would solve all the problems that are going on in the world today. But just that statement alone was abolished for indigenous people because our right to pray was forbidden. And so, you know, so grateful that that profound statement gave me the tenacity and gave me the passion mm-hmm. to continue on with the ceremonies and involve anybody, you know, who chooses to come, because everybody deserves to have peace within.
And you can learn those techniques through Moorhead Community Ed. Christy Ule is teaching Indigenous meditation on December 7th. And you can check out more options on their website, searching Moorhead Community Ed, for classes coming up later in the winter, some of which will be available via Zoom. Christy Ule Miigwech, thank you so much for your time today.
Che Miigwech to you as well. I appreciate you having me come in and share.
Still to come on Main Street, Tuba Christmas. But first, this news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Officials with the State Health Department are paying close attention to the Omicron variant of COVID-19 that originated in South Africa last month. Disease Control Section Chief Kirby Kruger says the variant was first detected on November 11th, and while it has not yet been found in North Dakota, it has since been found in California, as well as 23 countries on six continents. Along with Delta, Kruger says Omicron is a variant of concern due to the amount of mutations on its spike protein.
The SARS-CoV-2 virus mutates frequently, but what is concerning about this particular one is the number of mutations on the spike protein, with at least 32 that have been identified. And just as an example, Delta on that spike, the spike protein for the Delta variant, there's been at least nine mutations identified there. So it's quite an increase in the number of mutations on the spike protein.
Kruger says these mutations may increase transmissibility or reduce the effectiveness of vaccines or monoclonal antibody therapies. But for now, public health and science communities need time to observe and analyze the data. Kruger says the good news is that physical distancing, avoiding crowds, masking, and frequent hand washing are still effective at preventing the spread of COVID-19. He also says vaccinations are currently the best tool at reducing risk of serious infection, hospitalization, and death. Vaccination rates did jump up over 60% in North Dakota following the emergence of the Delta variant. Kruger says it remains to be seen how residents will respond to Omicron.
We are encouraging people to be vaccinated. We are hoping that, we're not trying to scare people into vaccination, but if people are motivated by the emergence of yet another new variant, we would encourage them to seek vaccination. There's lots of vaccines available.
Minnesota Housing Commissioner Jennifer Ho says renters facing the threat of eviction are still being encouraged to file an application with the Rent Help Minnesota program. Commissioner Ho says the state is currently seeing an uptick in applications for assistance. She says the month of November saw applications rise to levels equal to those at the peak recorded last May. She says efforts by lawmakers and the governor to increase program funding is helping new applicants and those who may have maxed out their initial 18 months of assistance.
We're in month 21 of COVID, and we know some folks have been hurting the whole time. We know some folks have had kind of varying levels of employment at different points in time. We know some folks are recently in need of assistance. So having the ability to use some of the state's fiscal recovery funds to be able to provide additional months of assistance, we are pleased about that.
Ho says even with the significant investments, there have been no indication the funding will be sustained. Despite ongoing needs, Ho says it's possible the program could come to a close sometime next year. And Grand Forks leaders are readying an application to the North Dakota Water Commission to draw 6.6 million gallons of additional raw water from the Red River each day. The request is expected to be submitted before the end of the year as part of the package to bring the Fufing Group to the city. The China-based company is looking to build a corn milling facility in North Grand Forks. City Administrator Todd Phelan says the application will also ask the state for a 60% cost share for the needed infrastructure.
Improvement as part of this project will be to add two pumps to our raw water intake that will deliver 8 MGD additional water through our intake. At our water treatment plant, we're going to build a pump station. And that pump station is going to pump the water north to the facility, to the Project Peony site.
The commission is expected to consider the application early in 2022. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Bill Dean, Realtor Broker with Alliance Real Estate of Bismarck, specializing in VA loans, home valuations, and estate planning. Bill can be reached at BillDeanHomes.com.
And there we have the mellow and beautiful tones of big horns doing Christmas music. Yes, once again, we are approaching the season for Tuba Christmas. And here to talk with us about it on Main Street, we have a couple of people involved with one of the four Tuba Christmas celebrations that are taking place around North Dakota. And you are involved with the Fargo-Moorhead one, Tim Wolenzine and Doug Neal. And is it hard to get a bunch of tuba players together? Where do you, How do you get them to come to this?
Just put word out and they show up. If they can be there, they'll be there. They love it.
Yeah. I noticed that the first one is in Williston this Saturday, and that one is at the James Memorial Library downstairs there at 1 o'clock in Williston. And then on Sunday, that's the one that you all are going to be involved with, and that's at West Acres Mall at 1 p.m. And then the following weekend, we've got Bismarck, Mandan, and Grand Forks doing theirs both on Saturday. The Grand Forks one is at the Grand Cities Mall, and the Bismarck Mandan one's at Legacy High School. These are very public events. What are the crowds like? What do you get out of the people who come to these?
Well, it's usually folks that just happen to be shopping that day, you know, that are wandering by. I mean, there's a few parents and loved ones that may wander in if they have a musician in the group, but mostly it's just your general holiday shopping audience that, and oftentimes they'll make a crowd and stand around, and sometimes even I think the mall sets up chairs, and you know, so there's folks that'll come and just listen to the whole thing.
Now, this is called Tuba Christmas. That's Tim Wollenstein, and he plays in it. Doug Neal organizes it. Doug, it's not just only tubas, right? There's related instruments as well.
Oh, well, the related instrument, there's a little controversy, maybe competitiveness there. You know, Tim plays the euphonium, accepted name. We tuba players kind of think of it as a tenor tuba, but kiddingly. So, yeah, euphonium and tuba, the main instruments in the group, and then variations on that. There can be sousaphones. There can be recording tubas, some people call them. But, you know, they're all basically tubes. You buzz your lips through and you adjust the length of the tube and you get a gorgeous sound.
Well, and they're big ones. And I can't help but notice both you guys are kind of big guys. Does it help to play the tuba if you are a large person?
Yes.
Yes. I mean, simply just because of the physics of it, right? The weight and the size, and, you know, you've got to have the right distance from your lap to your mouth, and you've got to have the strength to carry it. But, you know, there's lots of smaller people that play these instruments as well, and, you know, they figure out how to do it.
Yeah, okay.
But I got to say, it's no accident that the Chicago Symphony tubist is built like a linebacker. Happens a lot.
Uh-huh.
So now, what's the repertoire for these concerts? Is there a lot of literature in holiday music that's workable for the tuba chorus?
No, I'm trying to remember the name of the arranger, but these were arranged specifically for tuba euphonium ensembles. They're wonderful arrangements, and it's Harvey Phillips, who really was the progenitor of this, he was the teacher at the University of Indiana, low brass tuba teacher. And he had a friend that did these arrangements, and they are fantastic.
Now, why Tuba Christmas as opposed to, say, Tuba 4th of July or Tuba Halloween or something like that? There is a reason, yeah. Okay.
It has to do with William Bell, who was probably the most famous, preeminent tubist of the early 20th century. And he actually has some local roots. He was born in Iowa and is buried there, attended University of North Dakota for a year in the 1920s, went on to a very prolific career in New York, playing in orchestras, playing in bands. He was beloved by other tubists, you know, well, especially in New York City, but around the world, who took him as a father figure and was revered. He was a tuba teacher at the University of Indiana, passed away in 1973 after retiring. Well, here's why the Christmas connection. He was born on Christmas Day. And so in his memory, Harvey Phillips thought it would be a great thing to do Tuba Christmas in memory of William Bell. So there you go.
And it's been kind of rolling along for quite a while then.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Since the early 70s.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, as I said, there's four different Tuba Christmas performances in North Dakota this weekend in Williston and Fargo, and next weekend in Grand Forks and Bismarck, and they I assume take place all over the country. And
Yeah, there are hundreds of them that happen this time of the year that are organized in the same way in various communities. Tuba euphonium players sometimes, make this into almost a cult following, and the ones that are really into it will, look and see when there are some within driving distance and may hit several of them in one year. There's a badge that is created every year by the Tuba Christmas organization. And then those of us that show up to play on that day, we pay a little honorarium to the organizers for the community, and we get this button. And that's kind of a badge of honor, and you can wear that button to any Tuba Christmas around the country and be a performer there, but it's also kind of a keepsake.
Huh. So there's a national Tuba Christmas organization.
Yes, there is.
Kind of like there's Big Pharma and Big Oil, there's Big Tuba. Yeah. Too.
Well, yeah, Harvey Phillips has a son. I'm sorry, I don't remember his first name. Is it Tom? That has been carrying this on and does the business end of things and sends out the music. And, I'm actually kind of on pins and needles right now because I got a notice from UPS that all that stuff is just arriving sometime this week.
And it's Saturday, right? Or Sunday.
Sunday. So got to get here. Need those pins.
Oh, yeah.
So for somebody, I have been to a couple of Tuba Christmas events, but I'm assuming most of our listeners have not. What is it like to come to you all are performers, but could you talk about what the spectator or auditor experience is like?
Well, when the musicians get there, we usually gather a little bit earlier than the performance time. We set up usually, with the larger instruments in the back and the smaller instruments in the front. And, oftentimes there will be young kids there playing for the first time, and we like to pair them up with an older experienced person. And then we have these books, and they're all scored in four-part harmony. You find the book that you can read, and we go through there. The director announces the selection. Everybody turns to that page, and then we go. The parts are written within the appropriate ranges of the instruments that are there, so that it's not easy music, but it's not so hard that a good high school player can't play it.
Yeah, and I would say the sound is remarkable. I've been to a lot of different concerts of a lot of different kinds of music, and this is definitely a very distinctive sound. It's very enveloping. It's all those low frequencies, very warm. Some of the pieces have a little of that Tubby the Tuba kind of ponderous feel to them, but some of them are really beautiful and I mean, the ponderous ones are fun too, but those harmonies in the low frequencies, that's not a sensation you get a lot.
No.
No, and it really does, and especially in the space where we play this, a high ceiling, it really sounds fantastic. It is – a lot of people say they're surprised at how mellow it sounds because they're used to seeing brass, trumpets, trombones – that are brighter instruments, and here these euphonium and tubas, much mellower sound, yes.
Yeah.
And I would also say, by the way, there is a great educational component because young students playing these instruments don't often get the limelight. It's usually the trumpets and the saxophones. And this is one of the times where they can come out and really be in a community and see older people playing their instruments, and it's a fantastic motivator. I had a son that – well, he still plays tuba, but he played at every Tuba Christmas from sixth grade through his senior year. So, and he still plays when he can. So it's a wonderful kind of community, encouraging young students kind of event.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, again, Tuba Christmas in Williston this Saturday at 1 p.m. at the James Memorial Library, in Fargo at West Acres Shopping Center at 1 p.m. on Sunday. And in Grand Forks on Saturday at noon at the Grand Cities Mall, Bismarck Mandan, Saturday at 1:30 at Legacy High School. I assume the auditorium, but you'll find it by the sound. If you get close to Tuba Christmas, you can home in on it just by listening. Thanks for coming in and talking to us about it.
Thank you.
Tim Wollenstein, Doug Neal.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming along with our members and other sources here on Prairie Public.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by United Way of Cass Clay, bringing our community together, lifting families out of poverty, and creating a better tomorrow for all of us. When we believe united, we succeed united. Learn more at UnitedWayCassClay.org.
And by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, a Touchstone Energy Cooperative generating and delivering electricity to over 3 million consumers in 9 states, spanning from the Canadian to Mexican border.
This is Dakota Datebook for December 1st. North Dakota strictly upheld prohibition laws after entering as a dry state when it joined the Union in 1889. However, some residents had a hard time abiding by this law. Such was the case on this date in 1894 involving a man by the name of Major Fawcett. Though it may seem strange, that was his legal name, as confirmed by naturalization records bearing his signature from 1888, making him an official U.S. citizen. In a court case from 1894, Fawcett, who was operating a drugstore in Candu, was given a sentence of 90 days and a fine of $200 for selling liquor. On this date that year, the Bottineau Pioneer used the Fawcett case to criticize another paper, the Candu Record, for not being an advocate against prohibition laws. The paper said Fawcett was a better man today than the editor of some newspapers. Meanwhile, Fawcett was transported to Devil's Lake to serve out his sentence. This was not the first time Fawcett was in court, nor would it be his last. Mr. Fawcett continued to be a topic of interest in many counties of North Dakota, in both the court systems and the county newspapers. Fawcett would reappear in 1897 and several times in 1898 for prohibition-related crimes, the latter episode requiring bail of $300. In 1901, Fawcett applied for a druggist permit for the sale of intoxicating liquors for medicinal, scientific, and mechanical purposes. With this permit, he opened a drugstore in Pembina. All seemed well until he was found guilty of blind pigging in 1904, a blind pig being the name for an illegal liquor establishment. During this trial, the Pioneer Express stated, "It is nothing new for the major." The last trial he appeared at was a year later in 1905 with his business partner, J.H. Gallagher. They were both tried on the complaint from the state's Prohibition Enforcement League. The league was manned mostly by employees of detective agencies. Fawcett and Gallagher were acquitted, and Fawcett eventually went to work in Munich, North Dakota, where he was described as a first-class pharmacist. Major Fawcett's story ended with his death on July 31, 1915, with only a brief report in newspapers, a quiet end for a man with such a chaotic history. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Olivia Burmeister. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
That's it for this Wednesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, reporter Pat Springer has done a four-part series on the impact that mental illness is having on the criminal justice system. And he joins us to talk about the results of his investigative journalism. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Coming up right now, All Things Considered.